Tonight, we're going to travel pretty quickly, and we'll look at some of these scriptures together, but for the most part, it's right there in front of you. So if you'll just follow along, we'll take off. And what I'd like to talk to you about tonight, and obviously you're here because the talk is on integrity, but that's what we're going to talk about. And it conjures up a lot of different ideas, I think, to people. What is integrity? And a lot of what Gene said tonight had to do with the idea that if your walk doesn't match your talk, then you don't have much to go on. And hopefully tonight we will better define this idea of integrity and get an idea not only what integrity means to us individually, but more importantly, what does integrity mean to God? Because as I studied through this and tried to kind of distill down what I thought the scriptures had to say, I found that once you put all this together, really the Christian life is summed up in the idea of integrity. And that's what God has called us to. And so let's try to hone in on this. As I said, everything in here is in your handout, and some of these verses I took the liberty. I've got my wife, thank goodness, has slaved over this, so I put everything in front of you because nothing is left to chance here. So I'll flip through some of this, and if you want to follow, fine. If you just want to listen, that'll be fine too. I know y'all have had a long 7-8 hour drive. Is
that about one?
Did you? Yeah. So anyway, what words come to mind to y'all when you think about integrity? Does anything you can think of?
Honesty.
Yeah, honesty.
Truthfulness.
Yeah.
Faithful.
Complete. Unified. Undivided. And I think we'll see some of that as we look through some of the scriptures, this idea of being undivided, or whether we are divided or undivided. Any people that come to mind when you think of integrity?
I don't say that because he's sitting here.
Trish was going to come tonight, and I told her, go find another study, because you may tell on me while I'm going through this thing. Maybe she would say that. I don't know. Any personalities or people, present or past, that come to mind?
I think Dr. Billy Graham.
Very much so.
His ministry has survived for so many years. So many, while others are having great difficulty.
Sure. Well, Gene mentioned the one I put down. That's Tom Landry. I was, as I worked through this and searched for people who have integrity, I came home from our Monday night study and tried to catch the tail end of the Cowboys, and there was old Tom down on the sidelines, man, just steady as a rock. And so you may not like the way he calls plays or coaches football, but he is a man of integrity, no doubt. But I had to ask myself, you know, is this a term or a word that has really lost itself in our culture today? And many people would probably say that, although Proverbs 26, Solomon says, many a man claims to have unfailing love, but a faithful man who can find? So I think this search for integrity and men and women of integrity has been around a long time. And our culture may be no different than his. The other thing I looked at, just to try to draw perspective from today, is ideas or examples of integrity within our society. And I didn't come across a whole lot that was very encouraging. I thought about the workplace, and we were in the office the other day talking about this new movie out about the insider trading and the stock market and people who are willing to compromise anything and everything for money. It's been said one of the biggest losses to an employer is employees who walk off with tools, equipment, materials, and you go through a study on integrity, and the Lord really gets into some corners of your life. And I called Dave McClellan. He works in one of the other offices. And yesterday, because my 7-year-old was having a friend over, and they like to play doctor, and they wanted some plaster material. So I wasn't in the office, so I called Dave. I said, "Hey, Dave, would you bring them 3 rolls of plaster for Kaylee?" And he said, "Sure." And so I picked it up last night. We're up here setting up, and he said, "Oh, and by the way, I didn't pay for these." And I didn't even say anything to him. I just kind of, you know, we're busy. And then I got to thinking, here's my second example of people who don't have integrity. And I just asked one of my buddies to walk off with 3 rolls of plaster. And so when I came in tonight, I said, "Hey, before I talk to anybody about integrity, I want you to know I'll set that straight money when I get back to the office." So the Lord really works in your life when you go through a study like this. The last thing that really hits home to me, I'm a physician, family practitioner out in Killeen. Her husband's a resident. Any internal medicine?
Surgery.
Okay. And the thing that I get hit up for all the time, disability and sick days. And, boy, you just hate to see them coming, you know. And it brought up a situation really flagrant, in my opinion. A man I've been seeing for over a year, just a pleasant guy, came in one day. I've been managing for his hypertension, for his high blood pressure. And he told me, he said, "Well, I'm going to be retiring in a couple of months. And I've been with this company for a long time, and I'm looking forward to it." I said, "Well, that sounds really great." And he said, "But I've got a problem." I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Well, I've accumulated a lot of sick days. And in fact, I've accumulated over a month's worth of sick days. And they're just going to go for naught when I retire." And I talked to my boss, and he suggested I come and get some help from you. I thought, now, you know, that's like when God came to Adam and says, "What's this deal with the apple?" "Well, the woman you gave me, you know." But the boss apparently came up with this idea, and I said, at this time I was kind of catching wind of what was going on. He said, "Well, he said that if you could write me a slip, then I could take those days off." And I said, "Well, for what illness?" He says, "Well, whatever you want to put down." And I said, "Well, I hope it won't put you out too much, but I don't really want to put anything down, because there's nothing I can put down that's the truth." And at that point, he apologized. "Oh, I should have never asked you about this, you know, this anyway." He was kind of embarrassed about it, and fortunately the incident kind of blew over and we finished up. And about 2 days later, I'm in the office, and one of my partners in Waco — we have a satellite clinic out in Waco that y'all probably drove through on the interstate — and he said, "Hey, look out for Mr. So-and-so. He's coming wanting you to give him 30 days of sick leave before he retires." And I said, "Well, I've already had a talk with that gentleman 2 days ago." So anyway, moving on from the workplace, integrity in the workplace is something that is greatly lacking. Next area I looked at it was politics, and probably nothing has to be said with politics in terms of integrity. Gary Hart, and I mean, just, the list goes on and on. Of course, we watch with interest the Olympics and all these sports stars that are supposed to be our kids' heroes, and here's Ben Johnson. I think the thing that surprises me even more, being a physician and knowing that the test that tested positive for steroids in his was a number to a lab tech. It didn't say, "This is Ben Johnson's urine." It says, "This is number 12 tested." He tested the urine twice before he turned it over to the international committee. Then they matched the number up with the person. And what surprises me now is, here's a man who, in my opinion, there is no way he could not have known that this was going on, and yet he will stand there and deny it as though it were the truth. And anyway, athletics. And lastly, probably more important to us, is our own backyard, the church. And again, sometimes you hate to get up in the morning and look at the front page to find out who else has been and caught with their hand in the cookie jar or whatnot. But let's move into this idea of integrity. To me, I think when I started into this, I thought, well, I like to look at, well, let me just hit the big 10 today. You know, God's given those 10 commandments, and let's don't murder today. Keep the tongue under control a little bit, and God will be happy with that. But the reality of it is, this thing called integrity, God wants all of us. He wants the fine print, the fine details of our life. And that's really a lot what Gene had to say tonight, and so we'll move into that. I've got a definition. That's the only thing I didn't write on there. I'm not sure why that was, but the definition I came up with for integrity is as follows, and this is from a biblical context. Consistency and honesty that characterize the person who wants to obey and please God. The consistency and honesty that characterize the person who wants to obey and please God. It's been said that integrity is the glue that holds our private life and our public life together and keeps our actions and our words connected to the truth. I've listed in your handout there some ideas or ways that integrity is demonstrated, and I think we would all agree that those are pretty obvious, that we mean what we say, we'd like to say we live the way we say we believe, and that's a goal we all work towards. We do not pretend to be someone we're not, and you can look through those. But in short, God wants our lives to be undivided, that we should have nothing to cover up. And so with that in mind, let's look at 1 Kings 9, chapter 4, and I'll read this. This is God talking to Solomon. It says, "As for you, if you walk before me in integrity of heart and of righteousness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, 'You shall never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel.'" So here God tells Solomon, "I want you to be a man of integrity, as David your father was." Here we have in 1 Chronicles 29:17, it says, this is David speaking, "Now I know, my God, that you test the heart and are pleased with integrity. All these things I have given willingly and with honest intent." We move on to Psalm 78:72. God, this is spoken of David. It says, "David shepherded them," speaking of Israel, "with integrity of heart, with skillful hands he led them." And we'll hit one more. Proverbs 10:9, it says, "The man of integrity walks securely, but he who takes crooked paths will be found out." And that's been glaringly seen here recently. I did want to mention in Proverbs 11:3 this idea of single-mindedness or undivided, because it says, "The integrity of the upright guides them, but the unfaithful are destroyed by their duplicity." And I think there's nothing worse in the Christian life than having to cover your trail. You know, you just can't run unencumbered the race up before us if you're always wondering who's going to dig this next one up on me. So I had one more to look at in terms of the Old Testament, because here we have in Isaiah 45:22 God identifying himself with his character. He says, "Turn to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. By myself I have sworn, my mouth has uttered in all integrity a word that will not be revoked. Before me every knee will bow, by me every tongue will swear." So when God says this is a characteristic of myself, I think we need to pay attention. I came across this quote out of James, and that's the study we're doing, and in fact we'll launch into this next Wednesday night. But this came out of the Phillips translation, and I'll read it as Phillips has put it down. This is the old count of joy when you encounter various trials, which this week for me has been, I told Trish this afternoon as we raced out the door, geez, I wish we'd have covered this a week earlier. Maybe we'd be prepared for these trials. We're getting there. It says, "When all kinds of trials and temptations crowd into your lives, my brothers, don't resist them as intruders, but welcome them as friends. Realize that they come to test your faith and to produce in you the quality of endurance. But let the process go on until that endurance is fully developed, and you will find that you have become men of mature character, men of integrity, with no weak spots." He goes on here in Titus 2:7, "In everything set them an example by doing what is good. in your teachings show integrity. And 2 Corinthians 8:21 is an idea that we'll look at as we go into this. It says, "For we are taking pains," this is Paul, "to do what is right, not only in the eyes of the Lord, but also in the eyes of men." And initially I thought, well, obviously it's harder to maintain integrity in the eyes of God than it is in the eyes of man, because man's standards are much lower. But the reality of it is that God knows the heart, and only God knows the heart. And so what man sees and understands may be totally unintended. And I think we need to keep that in mind. I read Jerry White's book, Honesty, Morality, and Conscience. And he tells a story, and I think this illustrates it well, of the time that him and his wife went off to a hotel for a short weekend vacation. Well, they checked in, and he took a book and went out to the pool and sat down and was sitting in a lounge chair. And a gentleman came up and says, I'm going to be taking some pictures. Do you mind if you may be in a few of these? And he said, no, I don't care. He was sitting there reading his book. And so he sat there reading, and he looked around and realized that other people had come out and were sitting around the pool and were having their pictures, and several women were out there. And so he finished up his book, and he went on back in, and he got to thinking. He said, you know, the Lord really spoke to him about this. And he said, you know, it all seemed innocent enough, but then he thought, well, where are these pictures going to show up? And what are the people back in my church going to think when they see that I went off on a weekend and here I'm sitting around a pool with all these strange women, and where's my wife? And so he said, you know, God knew his heart. He had integrity with God, but he realized that people might misinterpret that. So he went back to the hotel manager and explained the circumstances, and the guy was very very agreeable and said, yeah, we'll be glad to do that, and gave him a chance to say, well, I'm a Christian, I'm a minister, and this just might not look right. So I think when we talk about looking good or having honesty in the eyes of man, that we have to be a little more cautious, because it may not be as it appears. And we can be clean before God, but we can look awfully bad before people. Why do we have this struggle? Well, the first thing I've listed is the enemy. 2 Corinthians 11:3 through 4 says, "But I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may be somehow led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ." So we all know that Satan, the father of lies, is out to compromise our integrity at every point. I got this next statement from Charlie Casebolt, although he probably got it from somebody else too, but I really like it. It says, "Satan operates from the premise that every man and woman has a price for which he will sell out and cease to function as an ambassador for Christ." And I think we each have to look within ourselves and realize whether it's money, pleasure, fame, power, something in there. Christ has given us the power to overcome, but Satan knows our weaknesses, and so we have to be on guard every day that Satan will try to attack us at that point. We have our own heart, Jeremiah 17:9. "The heart is deceitful above all things, beyond cure. Who can understand it?" And for those of y'all who are familiar with Gordon McDonald, is he a name you're familiar with and are aware of the recent circumstances of his infidelity and whatnot? He was on Dobson talk show the other morning, and I just caught the second part of it. But Dobson asked him, "How does this happen? You know, how does this happen to a man like yourself?" And he says, "Well, you know, we preach and we speak about the sin nature of man, the evil of man, but we really only see it theoretically. We only preach it. We see it in theology, but we really don't believe it, because every man, whether he's a woman, Christian or non-Christian, has the capacity for any and every sin. And until we come to grips with that, we're in big trouble." And he says, "If you would have asked me 6 months before this happened, what is your strongest character, it would have been my relationships. But that's where he got me." So we have to be cautious of our heart. Let's look at the world system, because I think that's going to be something that we deal with every day. I've got a quote from Joan Beck, who's a writer for the Chicago Tribune, a secular writer. Lying is commonplace in our society, sometimes for what may seem the best of reasons, often for personal gain, almost routinely for social or business convenience. And she puts in quotes, "Tell him I'm in a meeting." And I think the place that comes home to me, and probably at your house, is you're home, you're tired, and the phone rings. "Tell him I'm not here." You know, that patient's trying to find you. And
honestly say, "My daddy said he's not here."
Right. Well, truth and confessions. I have my own example for this. When I was a resident, I'd been moonlighting all night, and we had this special meeting at the hospital. We'd had it the year before. I thought it was a waste of time, but it was a high commitment thing. They want everybody to be there. And I originally had a conflict, and I wasn't going to be able to make it. So I had already told them I've got a conflict, which was legit. But that conflict came off my schedule, and so I actually did get to come home earlier than I anticipated. So I came home. I was wrestling with, well, should I go to the meeting? They already know I've got a legit excuse. So the phone rings, and Kaylee, who was probably 4 at the time, picks it up. Is Mike O'Neill there? "Just a minute." Trish told him, "I'm not here." She goes to the phone, tells him, "I'm not here." It was one of my co-residents. And so she hangs up the phone, and I'm sitting there going, now my first child says, "I'll get him," and my wife says, "He's not here. Who's he going to believe?" So I ended up eating crow on that one. I got in my car, drove to the hospital, and had to straighten that one out. Anyway, in terms of the world system, and I tell you, there are more verses on the world and what God thinks about it than you ever want to come up with, but I'll just list a few. James 12:2, it says, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." We went over this the other night. James 1:27, and this one really caught my attention because we always talk about religion. You know, what is your religion right? Is my religion right? But here is what God sees as true religion. It says, "Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this." This ought to catch everybody's attention when you see that. "To look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world." And boy, that one really caught home. So God sees that in a very, very succinctly where He wants us to be. 1 John 2:15, and if there's any doubt, it says, "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." So I don't think there's any doubt that God and His system and the world system are not running along together here. And I had to think back about our own country, because I think maybe 20, 25 years ago, I'm not going to say Christians had it easier, but if you violated the moral or ethical laws of our country, you really violated God's laws too. They were almost running succinctly. If you were close approaching God's law and violating it, human law, American ethics was right behind it. And so maybe in a sense it was helpful. But I think today there's no doubt that God's laws and the world's laws, or at least in the States, are worlds apart. God has still set an absolute, and we have moved to a relative system. And basically we're to the point where every man does what is right in his own eye. And if the world system were to put out its philosophy, it's get away with whatever you can get away with. If you can beat the system and not get caught, you're a winner. And so I think that tells us that we have got to stay within God's standards, and we've got to know God's standards. And I had to throw in Joshua 1:8, the idea that we have got to know God's Word, because day by day, moment by moment, we come across circumstances and events. If we don't have a marker, if we don't have a guidepost from God's law, we're like James says, a ship without a rudder out there, and it's a dangerous place to be. So if we're not part of the world systems, we are ambassadors, and Gene mentioned that tonight, and I cringed as he scanned across it and then went on, because I think that's an important idea. He mentions 2 Corinthians 5:19, says here, and he has committed to us the message of reconciliation, just as Gene said tonight. We are therefore Christ's ambassadors, as though God were making his appeal through us. Now, there we've identified the idea that we're ambassadors, but another point of this verse that really struck me is as follows. It says, we implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him, and this is what hit me, we might become the righteousness of God. And I thought, I don't want to claim that. I'm not going to be the representative of God's righteousness on earth, but that is what he's given us the responsibility of being. And I haven't gotten over that one yet. I'm still trying to come to grips with the idea that he has called us through Christ to be the righteousness of himself. I got a little story here. It says, Alexander the Great had a soldier in his army who bore his name but was a great coward. The emperor, enraged at his conduct, justly said to him, either change your name or learn to honor it. And, boy, there are times that I sometimes wish I, you know, I'm sure God is cringing at the thought that I am his ambassador, but the reality of it is that is a job that has been given to us, and we can't change our name now. What does an ambassador do? He represents the home country. He tries to make Christ appear in his best light, to make it attractive, as John 10:10 says, you know, he has come that we might have life and have it more abundantly. And he tries to win others over to the philosophy of his own country. Two ways that's done. Your lifestyle. And we have two quotes, one out of Philippians and one out of 1 Corinthians. Both of these are Paul. The first one I carry a little more to heart because it says, join with others in following my example. So here Paul is again calling us to follow his own example and take note of those who live according to the pattern we gave you. So really he's calling two examples to be followed. And because then in 1 Corinthians 4:16 he says, therefore I urge you to imitate me. And I think just as Gene said tonight, we may be the best Christians some people know. And so there's a song that I used to listen to. It says, you may be the only Jesus some may ever know. And so we are representing him. And then verbally, we are to be prepared to give an answer for the hope that is within us. And I think that speaks to the idea that if our conduct and our words are joined and we're living the life that we should, the opportunities will be there. But we need to, you know, the idea is, well, what would you say if someone were to come up and say, what must I do to be saved? I mean, that doesn't happen to me very often, but those opportunities should be there and we should have a plan. I'm not saying we need to have something wrote, but we need to know, how do we lead somebody to the gospel? I heard a story the other day that somebody interviewed Gandhi, and he said, Hinduism satisfies all my needs. He said, I studied in England, and at the time I might have very well accepted Christianity if it had not been for the Christians that I knew. And so that one, again, hits right at home. The other thing that I want to hit on is that as Christians and as ambassadors, we are aliens. We should look, act, and sound different. 1 Peter 2:11 says that, dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world. And I sit down and sort of jotted out what are the characteristics, because I find myself at times feeling like a spy instead of an ambassador. Because an ambassador, he dresses, he speaks, his customs are different. He sticks out in his culture, in his country, like a sore thumb. This guy's not from the United States. He's from Scotland or from Afghanistan. He looks, he acts different. And that's what God has asked us to be. But there are many times that I'm afraid in my own life that I look more like a spy. And I thought, what does a spy look like? Well, he blends in. He looks, he acts, he sounds just like the people around him. And so I think we need to look at our lives and ask, would people recognize me in this crowd? Because Christ has asked us to go out to the sick, to the needy, to the sinners, and when you're out there, there's going to be some bad things going on, and we have to decide, are we going to be distinct, or are we going to be the same? Lastly, we have a loyalty to citizenship. In Philippians 3:20 it says, but our citizenship is in heaven. So no matter how well integrated into society we become, we need to remember that we belong only to Christ. I wanted to recount one example that I think is very indicative of a man of integrity, and that is the story of Daniel. And I'll briefly review a very familiar story, and then I'd like to look at a few aspects of Daniel's life that I think very well characterize a man of integrity. But in Daniel 6, we find Darius, who was the king of the Medes and Persians at that time, setting up his administration, and he set 120 satraps, which are essentially governors over his ruling kingdom, and he picked three men to look over them to make sure they didn't steal or take what wasn't theirs, and one of those men was Daniel. Now, Daniel really had seniority here, because if you look through the story of Daniel, Daniel had been around a long time interpreting dreams and doing all these things, and so obviously these other two men were probably junior to him, but these three men were placed in charge. And then Daniel, who obviously outshined the rest, was ready to be put into basically the vice chairmanship. He was going to be promoted, and that's when all this turmoil came up. The people that were working with him decided, well, we don't like this guy, and we're going to fix him. And so they wanted to blackmail him first with reference to his job, but they couldn't, and so they realized there was only one thing they could truly count on, and that was his faithfulness to God, and that's where they planted the trap. So they went to the king, and they played into his vanity, and they said, well, for the next 30 days, if anyone prays to any other god or man other than you, have him put to death. And the king, not knowing their plan, he thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. So that's what he did. And then Daniel heard of this, and so Daniel did as he had always done. He went up to his room and he prayed, and that was where they caught him. And so they brought him before the king, and they said, well, this guy has violated your law, and he's to be put to death. So before we finish the story, which everybody's familiar with, let's look back and at a couple aspects of this. In Daniel 6:3, it says, now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. And so here we see a man who had so distinguished himself, and I thought, boy, wouldn't every employer love to have a guy like this working for him? And I think, does my boss, you know, does he think, boy, that O'Neill, he really does the job. He never gives me any grief. He just does his work. He does it with integrity. But I think the one thing that I see a big problem with in my office and across the board and people who work is their attitude. And that is the attitude of, man, I'm just going to plug in and plug out and just get by on getting by. I remember when I first started working summers during school, during college, I got hired on at this construction site, and they told me to go over and dig this ditch, and so I'm over there just digging away, and this guy walks up to me, looked like he'd been around for a while, and he said, you need to learn not to work so hard. And I kind of looked at him, and he said, you're going to make the rest of us look bad. So I realized that when you're working union, there's a certain pace that you work at, or they don't like it very much. And I thought about Gene's story, not about the carpenter out there. And I imagine he was, well, I won't say anything about the unions, because that, but it, maybe he was a non-union man. But every morning, Colossians 3:23 through 25, we think, whatever you do, do your work heartily as to the Lord rather than to man, because that's who will answer for at the end. Not my boss, unless you just mess up so bad they fire you, but ultimately God's going to want to know, how did you perform your duty? Because I think God will honor that at the end. moving along with Daniel in the fourth chapter, it says, fourth verse, at this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel and his contract and his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Now, I'd like to find a man in our government right now that could be said about, because, I mean, every day you pick up the paper, somebody is plastered on the front page, and I guess it doesn't speak highly, at least for our government officials today, although I'm sure there are some very godly men who are really trying to serve the country. But here we find a guy who was faithful, trustworthy, and the idea of not negligent. Not only was he trustworthy and without corruption with what he did on a day-to-day basis, but he was looking ahead. Proverbs 23:3, I've cited here, says, a prudent man sees danger and takes refuge, but the simple will keep going and suffer for it. So the godly man, the man of integrity, not only is he dealing on a day-to-day basis, but he's looking ahead. How am I going to take care of this in the best and most appropriate way? Lastly, we see in that as a man of personal purity. And it was interesting, again, that they obviously went through his record with a fine-tooth comb, and they could not find anything to bring against him. So we bring this down to the end, Daniel 6. It says, finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless this has something to do with the law of his God. So he stuck out there. He was an ambassador. They said, well, we're not going to nail him on his job, but we know one thing for sure about this guy. He's faithful to his God. So that's where we're going to get him. And then they went to Darius and concocted all this thing. And it says, now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. So here we see a man who has a consistent walk with God. He's not like me, you know, trouble's brewing and you're scrambling to the throne, you know, help God, you know. It's like Daniel said, boy, you know, here's a problem, and I've been there before, I'll be there again. He was consistent as he had done before. He went before God, he brought the circumstances to him, and he was faithful. And I couldn't help but think, here's a man who is an administrator over, well, if you figure that there's three of them, there's 120 that they're governing, some 40 men, and I think his daytimer couldn't look any worse than mine, and yet he did find time to meet with God. And it was only through that he was able, I think, to efface the adversity that was ahead of him. Now, this is one of those stories, my kids, and you'll get to meet my kids, for better or worse, they're always saying, it's not fair, you know. She got to do this, he got to do that. And this is one of those stories where it's just not fair. You know, here's Daniel, a man of integrity. The king loves him, and where does he end up? It cost him the lion's den. In fact, even Darius was upset that this was going to happen. He tried to find a way out of it, but he couldn't. But Daniel was faithful and says that after they threw him in the lion's den and the slab was rolled over, the king went home. He had a restless night. He ran back out. What happened to Daniel? Was his God faithful? And as we know, he was. And so Darius takes all these guys that had plotted against Daniel and their families and their kids and throws them all to the lions. And so what was the end result of Daniel's faithfulness? Well, it says in 26 through 27, I issued a decree that in every part of my kingdom, this is Darius now speaking, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the kingdoms, in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lion. So, there's a situation now in my office that a guy he feels was unjustly ticketed, He's going to contrive a way to get out of this, you know, and it's just not above board. And I just said, life is not always fair, but that is not what we're called to uphold. God will set things right at the end. We have only got to maintain integrity. And I'm sure Daniel would have, you know, loved, well, I wasn't really praying. I was, you know, I mean, he could have said, I wasn't praying to my God, I was praying to you. He could have wiggled his way out of this one, but he stuck to his guns. So we've covered a lot in terms of defining integrity and where we're to be, and I guess now we're going to try to put the rubber on the road, and we're going to say, how do we implement this in our own life? And the first thing I've got there is that we have to make it our goal. Paul writes in Acts 24:16, so I strive always again to keep a clear conscience before man and God. And again, that dual standard that we have to live up to. We have to avoid a life of hypocrisy. And again, I think this comes back to the idea of duplicity or double-minded. We cannot always be looking over our shoulder. We have got to set the record straight. Not that we're going to be sinless, that we're going to be perfect, but when we realize we've just asked our buddy to bring three rolls of plaster home and we just never even thought about it, we go, hey, I got to set this thing straight. Because otherwise, you just never know where that sucker's going to surface on you down the line. I've referenced here Romans 2:21 through 24, and again, this speaks right to today. Here he's talking and says, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourselves? You preach against stealing, do you steal? You say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the laws? And then the last thing I want to be said about me is said here, as it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And no doubt the message of Christ right now is at least got a black eye from all that's been going on recently. Honesty. And I think that was referenced as one of the words up front of what integrity means. In Proverbs 6:16-19, we have six things that God hates and seven that he detests. And two of those have to do with honesty. He hates a lying tongue and a false witness who pours out lies. So we have to be men and women of honesty. Ephesians 4:25 says that we are to put off falsehood and speak truthfully. And I've written a little catchy saying in there. It says, stretching the truth won't make it last any longer. I came across another one. It says, the devil has many tools, but a lie is the handle that fits them all. So we have to be honest. And right in line with that is the idea of the tongue. And unfortunately, James says more about the tongue than I sometimes want to hear. But others have spoken about the tongue. Ephesians 4:29. This is another one that I've tried to commit to memory because it helps me as I go through the day. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear. And I thought, if everything that came out of my mouth was wholesome, maybe I wouldn't have a lot to say for the day, you know, if I just kept it to that. 1 Peter 3:10 says, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from deceitful speech. And back to James again, we're on this idea of religion and religious. If anyone considers himself religious and yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. We move into obeying the law. 1 Peter 2 and Romans 13 basically just establishes the fact that God has instituted the authority that we live under. And unless those authorities place us in jeopardy of compromising God's law, then I think we're obligated to stick to the rules. No one is above the law, and there are no exceptions. Although we'd all, I thought about that this Wednesday afternoon pulling out of our parking lot, and there's this stop sign that I just hate to see. It's just, I mean, there's no reason for it. We're all thrown on the side. You know, what's this stop sign here for? But those are the laws that are before us. There are no exceptions. Again, back to the honest day's work, and I've just referenced Colossians 3:23 through 25 again, and I think the biggest thing I hit upon in that is the attitude of our work. Then we're into the servant's heart. I think you probably heard Charlie Casewell say this, that he has a servant's heart. He keeps it in his pocket every day. And he's got one that he carries around with him now. It's a little heart that he puts in his pocket, so he can say he has a servant's heart. But we look at the world system there, and somebody referenced the other night at our study, you know, some of the most popular book, Looking Out for Number One, and the commercials we see, and that is the idea that, you know, if you don't get it, somebody else is going to take it, and that is not what was in Christ's mind when he came to the earth. Matthew 20, he says, whoever wants to become great among you must be a servant. Mind control, and I don't mean that in some mystic way, but I've probably got more references there than any, because to me, that is the battlefield. That's the seed where the evil starts in our minds, and that's my constant battlefield. 2 Corinthians 10:5 says that we are to take capture every thought to make it obedient to Christ. 1 Peter 1:13 says we are to prepare our minds for action. I like that word. And Romans 12:2, we've come over before about the world, that we are to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. And Philippians 4:8, if we don't know, well, what does that mean? Well, he tells us what that means. Here's the things he wants you to think about. Things that are true, noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, excellent, praiseworthy. So if we could hit on those things, we don't have to worry about what else we need to think about. I want us to read, and I didn't write this one down, but Psalms 15, 1 through 5. Psalms 15, 1 through 5. I'll read it in the NIV. Here's the outline for a man of integrity, according to David. He asks, Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? And here we have him, and I've listed him on the outline. He whose walk is blameless and who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from his heart and has no slander on his tongue, who does his neighbor no wrong and casts no slur on his fellow man, who despises a vile man but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps his oath even when it hurts, who lends his money without usury. I'll do this, or are you just saying yes because you want to be nice, and in reality you realize the chances of me showing up for this function are nil, you know. But here's a guy, the man of integrity, even when it hurts, you know. Would you help me come over and put in my sprinkler system? Yeah, he's over, you know, then you're there. So for me, that means I either need to speak the truth in love and say, boy, I can't make it, or I need to say I'll be there and be there. In closing, I've got two things. Just as Gene did, I always like to leave with a story. And as he says, if you've heard this, don't spoil the punchline. But I got this out of our Daily Bread. It says, my friend Herb Tyler, an evangelist, told me of something exciting that happened because of a call he had made on a payphone. After he gave the operator his name and told her the number he wanted, he deposited his money in the slot, talked a few minutes, and hung up the receiver. When he did, all his coins were returned. Calling the operator, Herb said, I don't know if you're the one who took my call just now, but my coins came back. I know, she said, I was in your audience tonight when you spoke on integrity. I won't make any phone calls tonight, I guarantee. And I wondered if you practice what you preach. So I flipped the lever and I returned the coins. The so-called Christians I know don't live like it. It said Tyler put his coins back in the box, but only after making an appointment to talk to the operator in person, and as a result, she trusted Christ. So I had my talk all together, and maybe I should have ended there, but I came across one other thing, and I thought it was important enough that I've printed it out on your worksheet, and if you'll read through it with me. This is what A.W. Tozer says. The church at this moment needs men, the right kind of men, bold men. We languish for men who will feel themselves expendable in the warfare of the soul. who cannot be frightened by threats of death because they have already died to the allurements of this world. Such men will be free from the compulsions that control weaker men. They will not be forced to do things by the squeeze of circumstances. Their only compulsion will come from within or from above. They will make no decisions out of fear, take no course out of a desire to please, accept no service financial considerations, perform no religious act out of mere custom, nor will they allow themselves to be influenced by the love of publicity or the desire for reputation. And that's a mouthful. I meditated on that, I thought about that, and the thing that the Spirit really ministered to me was this idea that they feel themselves expendable in the warfare of the soul. And I thought about that for a while, and I thought, I don't want to be thought of as expendable. I mean, that's just not something you want. I mean, I'm vital. I mean, I'm important to my family, to my patients. I don't like that idea of being expendable. But I think that's what he goes on to say, that they have no fear of death because they have already died. And just as Gene spoke tonight about the wheat and that it has to die before it can produce. And then I thought that Paul made that same claim of himself, that he might become the sin of his people that they might be saved. But the ultimate was that Christ saw himself as expendable. And at first, that didn't mesh. How can Christ and expendable, they just don't go together. So I looked up this idea of expendable. I looked up the word expendable, and the word means worth sacrificing to gain an objection. Worth sacrificing to gain an objective. And I thought about Christ and what he says, that he gave his life as a ransom for many. He saw himself as expendable for the joy that God set before him.